Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this episode, that means you've gathered at the crossroad and spoken the correct set of phrases to summon myself, Ashley Darrow, and the one, the only, John, aka the Litcrit guy, here to discuss a fancy and exciting new proposal for you. How's it going, John?
You know what? I'm so tired of a life with the dust and mold of books. I just wish I'd seen a bit more of the world, you know? Truly, life is not found in grad school, and you know, maybe there's a deal to be made here.
So before we hit record, I was like, this is probably the most relatable horror movie that we've talked about here on the show for me, because what is Faust about at its core? It's an academic who gets offered a job outside of academia, immediately gains 20 years back on his life, meets a series of incredibly hot babes he falls in love with, and finds the cure for the plague, so actually contributes to society. The second he leaves academia, it's just the wonders of the world open up for him. So shout out to Faust. Ex-ed, quitlet Faust.
Yeah, teaching us don't go to grad school.
Well, I think that's the dark thing about this, too, is if you've been in grad school too long, the only way out is a bargain with Mephistopheles.
Yeah, otherwise you're there forever, unless you sign the special contract.
Oh, yeah, Mephistopheles shows up with a zero-hour contract for adjunct teaching. Oh, no. Oh, dear. Well, we could spend this entire episode.
Go on.
I was gonna set you up for a little book reading. Well, we could spend this entire episode kind of bemoaning our former careers as people in higher education, or we could discuss something I find more exciting, and that's the utopian potential that unlocks when you leave higher ed. And I know I couldn't think of anyone better to read us a little something special about utopia and the works of Ernst Bloch. Take it away, John.
We feel within ourselves a great need, and to go even further, we do not yet even know who or what we are. Right at the beginning of the third volume of the English translation of The Principle of Hope, Ernst Bloch puts it like this. From early on, we want to get to ourselves, but we do not know who we are. All that seems clear is that nobody is who we would like to be or could be, hence the common envy, namely, of those who seem to have, in fact, to be what we are entitled to. But hence, also the desire to start something new, which begins with ourselves. Attempts have always been made to live commensurately with ourselves. We have in us what we could become. In a sense, we are pushed into the future through this dialectical tension, and on the collective level, the incompleteness and inexhaustible nature of our own shared history is both a resource and catalyst for a shared process of struggle. In the age of capitalist realism, Bloch's injunction against pessimism, a Marxist does not have a right to be a pessimist, might strike the listener as slightly odd, a willful denial of the facts. Yet what interests me about the claim is the use of the word right. Pessimism is a choice for what, to do what. I think if we idolize the concept of pessimism, we think of it as a cold-hearted appraisal of just what is. And it is this which I think is precisely Bloch's problem with pessimism. It involves choosing to settle for the facts in front of us and choosing not to see the latencies and possibilities within those facts. If hope is the philosophy of the future, then pessimism is about the abnegation of that future. The pessimist sees only the now at the cost of the novum. The Marxist has a responsibility to be the one who looks beyond the mere appearance of reality to both accept and take on its incompleteness. The Principle of Hope points out that through all of history, there is no such thing as just the way things are. And so, if we have new ways of reading our present from there, we can begin building out the shared processes of concrete utopia. As Bloch put it at the end of Atheism in Christianity, far from being a contradiction in terms, concrete utopia is the firmest of handholds, and by no means only where the propaganda and implementation of socialism is concerned. The whole surplus force of culture finds its salvation there, and these forces are becoming more and more relevant to us all the time. Originally, The Principle of Hope was supposed to have a different title, Dreams of a Better Life. Can I ask something of you? Wherever you are, close your eyes, just for a moment. What do you dream of? Do you have the dreams of a better life? The unshakable feeling that the world is not right? The beautiful and comforting thing about Bloch's crowning achievement is the philosophical commitment to the simple truth that those dreams mean something, and that they are the ground on which we all may find a greater world yet to come into being. The great joy and inspiration of reading Bloch's work, and perhaps The Principle of Hope particularly, is a kind of cross and trans-historical solidarity. To look at the world and see that it could be otherwise can be a profoundly lonely and isolating experience, especially under the psychic weight of a capitalist realism that drives home the message again and again that there is no alternative, that reality is closed, the horizon of possibility has collapsed. Facing an ever-escalating series of crises, we are in such desperate need of the Promethean idea of Blochian Marxism that can reawaken the sense of potential within our shared and collective agency. Join us as we discuss Faust.
Oh, that rules. That is great. And I couldn't think of a better place to kick this discussion off with. So that little reading you just gave us there, is there any chance that's part of a larger published work that our listeners could acquire for their own personal reading, enjoyment, and book collecting?
If you listen to the show, you know I've been talking about Ernst Bloch for way too long. And now there is a short pamphlet-length book out with Zero Books called A Primer on Utopian Philosophy. It is very cheap. It is part of Zero Books' amazing series on utopia. This is a really good way into thinking about utopian philosophy. And hopefully... Yeah, if Bloch, I think, is really intimidating, is really difficult to get into because the books are very long, they're very German, they're very philosophically dense. And so the aim of A Primer on Utopian Philosophy is to kind of catalyze your own engagement with Bloch. It is not about giving you the kind of the one right way of reading this philosopher, but enough information so that you feel like you can start with it.
And dear listeners, I can't stress enough how good John's primers are. You know, I know I've shared the story before on the show, but I first found the works of the Litkirk guy through the primers that you write, as well as your Theory Time threads on Twitter from a million years ago, which were effectively primers on whatever book you were reading at the time, all of which were fantastic. And I can't recommend them enough as a great place to get started understanding a particular philosopher, a particular set of works. Links will be down in the show note. The book is out now. Order it while it's hot, while it's fresh, while it's crispy off the shelves.
Yeah. And don't just order that one. Order the rest. Order the rest in the Zero Utopia series.
They are all really, really good. I've got to say, I've been thoroughly impressed by what's come out of the Utopia series so far.
Yeah, there's a great book on pessimism in contemporary television. There's a great book on Adorno and radical black philosophy. There's a great book on degrowth eco-socialism and the film Zardoz.
Good one. That has this. Been my favorite so far. I should say second favorite now. You picked F.W. Murnau's Faust as kind of the vehicle for a discussion of Ernst Bloch's work, utopian left philosophy in general. I found this to be a very exciting and enticing choice for this discussion because, you know, we have the word Faust from this movie and the Faustian rather from these mythologies. And Faust is well known for, I think, being a bit of a downer. So I guess, do you want to kick things off by like letting us know why Faust was the movie that kind of guides this philosophical discussion?
Yeah. So, okay. So for people who don't know, Bloch is a early 20th century Marxist philosopher in Germany. He mm-hmm. is basically every philosopher from Europe who is even somewhat famous on the left. Adorno, Benjamin, Lukács, all of them knew him and all of them were writing mm-hmm. in some way either against him or in conversation with him. In like he's enormously prolific and he is a kind of like one of the linchpins around which the entire tradition of Western Marxism moves. But in, like to my perception of it, he is like immensely under-discussed in mm-hmm. like Anglophone scholarship or just on like the Anglophone left. He's really well read in Latin America. He's really well read in Turkey. He's not really all that well read on or read on the same level as he is in the UK and America and other Anglophone kind of left spaces. The big influence on Bloch's writing, like Bloch is Adorno describes Bloch's writing as these great passages of Bloch music, right? He's an incredible... He writes beautifully about music, and he writes, like, poetically and, like, in a literary tradition that we would call, like, high modernism. Like, it's, mm-hmm. like, look, it's, like, bombastic. The big influence on Bloch's work, other than Marx, the person he quotes the most is Goethe, is Johann Goethe, and Goethe's most famous work is Faustus, the two-part play. The mm-hmm. Faust, obviously, there's in English, Marlowe's Faustus is probably more famous, but in terms of like the influence on German intellectuals, on German art, Goethe's Faust is like canon. This is the book. This is the theater. Mm-hmm. This is the philosophy. And this is Murnau's adaptation of it in German Expressionism. Bloch, for someone who's interested in Bloch, right, philosophically and on a literary basis, this is amazing. Bloch was also an incredibly high-profile defender of the artistic avant-garde of Expressionism in the 20th century, of modernism. And so this is a perfect movie to talk about.
Fantastic. And I am a big Faust fan. So I am so excited to dive into this film, German Expressionism for the win, as the kids mm-hmm. would have said approximately 15 years ago.
Faust. Can we just start by talking about, like, so this is, it's by F.W. Murnau, who makes Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
This film,
legend, king.
This film looks incredible.
Yes.
I know we don't normally like to do the thing where we just kind of like gush. But like this is a film from 1926, from 99 years ago, like at the very beginning of cinema as like a form of art.
Mm-hmm.
And like what do you think about this on a kind of formal and practical level?
There's just so much to say about Murnau's work in general, and I rewatched this a few days ago in prep for this episode. I had watched all of Murnau's stuff in my teen years because Murnau is in the public domain and all of his movies show up in the like 100 horror movie classics box sets. You know, you'll get a fistful of Murnau movies in there, and like just the effects work is just so powerful. You really feel this movie in a way that I think, and we'll talk about this in a bit, but in a way that has quote unquote aged very well, that holds up in quotes with contemporary cinematic standards. How about you? What are your impressions?
Honestly, I think
here?
The special effects are just so good. Like one of my favorite shots is like the reveal of Mephisto's contract. where like it's kind of like unveiled in letters of fire, done in camera, and it's like it's just amazing. Like obviously, expressionism, they often talk about the set design and deliberate non-realism of it, but like so much of this, as you say, really still holds up. And I guess I don't know, maybe we can kind of interrogate that idea of like, what does it mean for something to hold up on screen for so long?
We need to Yeah, so the scene that always gets it for me in this one is when the devil unleashes the plague
on so
Faust's
good.
hometown, and every time I see that scene, I'm just like, if it weren't for the fact that I can see things that are technical to the specific era of film in this, like how degraded the copies are and stuff like that, like you couldn't do that better with CG today. And I think it's important to like dwell on the whole idea of effects holding up. And this will also be something we touch on a bit in the discourse zone. I was about to call it the degrowth zone. but no, like the idea of effects holding up has, I think, a lot of like implicit prerequisite ideas that have to be accepted for that framework to be able to express anything of meaning. And I think first and foremost in them is that capitalism, as part of its own internal mythologies, right, is always producing something that's not only new, but that is better than what has been produced previously. And better on every level. It's technically better. It's morally better. It's ethically superior. It's the correct new thing, whatever capitalism's putting out. And so we have these discussions where it's like, oh, the CG in Jurassic Park holds up so well, as if like the kind of, as if there's some kind of like inherent teleological and temporal competition between Faust, Jurassic Park, and the Marvel movies in terms of their effects. And if there's not, it's also as if there's not greater material conversations we can have about like art evolving over time, art traditions existing and kind of flowing back and forward into each other, rather than this kind of the flat discussion of, oh, well, whatever the new red camera is, whatever the new CG trick is, those are all better than what was previously produced.
You are so entirely correct. And that sort of like the economy of cultural production is inherently tied up in a certain set of philosophical aesthetic commitments of what film is supposed to do. And in like increasingly, it's supposed to be like, film is about verisimilitude. It is supposed to look quote unquote real. But like,
yeah,
Faust doesn't look real, right? That incredible shot of Mephisto unleashing the plague upon the village, it's obviously a model, right? It's quite obviously a model. And Murnau's not an idiot, right? Like, and Murnau and his cinematographer knew what they were doing, right? Stylization allows for imagination and craft in a way that the meticulous reproduction of reality does not allow for. Right, realism is a set of generic conventions, right? Realism is not real, right? Realism is a certain kind of cinematic language that is often bound up within the forces of production that produce those cultural products. And it's like the thing that makes Murnau's incredible composition of the shot, you know, where you have like space and light being used in such interesting ways, are that like even 99 years after the fact, with a completely silent film, you have a film that is captivating, not because it's realistic, but because it is enchanting, right? Because you fall into this film rather than expecting it to be a mirror to the reality that we already know.
I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that's a fantastic way of looking at this one. And I think we're going to, realism will be popping up in the discourse zone. I can just feel it in my bones. Go on.
I was just going to say like one of the very famous things that Bloch talks about is expressionism, this artistic movement of the 20s and 30s. He gets into a very famous series of exchanges, a series of dialogues between him, Bertolt Brecht, and Georgi Lukács about expressionism. And Bloch is quite pro this German expressionism because to him, it shows the kind of fracturing of the social totality. Murnau does great crowd work in this film.
Yeah.
Like particularly the opening, like at the fun fair or the circus before the plague strikes. Mm-hmm. Or like people running in the streets dying. But the social totality in expressionism is shown to be fractured. It's falling apart. And so there's this kind of new internal psychological drama that gets worked out. Lukács famously hates expressionism. I think it's kind of bordering on like fascist irrationalism. And so their debate is super interesting in the context of this film because in many ways this is not a new thing that's being done, right? This is the latest iteration of Faust, which is 500 years old in Germany. So I'm like, mm-hmm. you can't expect this story to stay in the mode of like traditional 19th century realism. It has to become, it's always already being reread.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to like, we'll carry this into the discourse zone in just a moment, but like that same interrogation, I think carrying on that discourse that Bloch was having in his time is so worth it today because we have kind of the inversion of the same discourse happening in popular cinematic criticism with the way that people approach CG in cinema, the way that people approach realism and effects. I think echoes that conversation in ways that are quite interesting. But before we get real, I think we should get realer and discuss the thing that actually destroyed contemporary cinema, the kind of horrible special effects creation that ruined movies forever, and that's talkies.
Yeah, we hate to say it, but the cinema is dead and the talkies killed it.
Back in my day, actors actually had to act in order to show emotion and expression. Now they can just use words to tell you how they feel, and it has taken the craft entirely out of cinema.
Can we also, I think it's worth pointing out that the original intertitles for this film were written by someone who'd won the Nobel Prize.
Right?
Like, arguably one of the most famous writers in Germany at the time wrote the intertitles for the first version, and they were redrafted later. But it's like... Mm-hmm. The acting is so expressive precisely because like okay, what's your favorite kind of scene if we're going to talk about acting?
Ooh. Oh, this is so tough. You go first. I'm picking between two and I'm wondering if you're going to pick either of them.
The hands down the funniest and best bit, one of my favorite bits is Mephisto with Gertrude's aunt, where it's like mm-hmm. the kind of like almost like a Scooby-Doo bit where he's like chasing around the kitchen because he's mm-hmm. made her this love potion. I just think in a way silent cinema reminds me of comic books. Mm-hmm. Right, everything is told through the image. It is sequential narrative art in a really sort of like, it has an immediacy to it that is just, it's just so appealing.
Right? And also, like, my favorite scene is another Mephisto scene. Because you've got, it's when Mephisto's outside the church. And he goes to walk into the church and sees the cross. And then he's like, oh no! And he has to go, like, cower in the shade for a moment. And just the series of expressions on his face convey such, like, a rich bouquet of emotion where it's like, For a brief moment, like it's like he's just thinking to him. It really, to me, looked in this last watching with it, he's thinking to himself, like, oh God, I'm such a dork. Like, of course there'd be a cross in the cathedral. Why did I try to run in there? And then he's like trying to gather himself. You know, he's like, I'm a professional. I'm at work. I can do this. And it's just so strong. And I think that kind of speaks to something that's magical about silent era cinema, too, where that's like, because the actors have to rely solely on expressions and the sparse bit we get from the intertitles, we as the audience and we as the viewer have a lot more like lateral freedom to change our interpretations of these characters, you know, and to kind of like grow and evolve with the cinema and change it just a little bit more, I think, than talkies afford us, because talkies kind of just give you everything.
Yeah.
Oh, I love the fact we're complaining about talkies.
I also love all of the performances. Gösta Ekman as Faust is incredible, as both young and old Faust. The makeup work is incredible. You're completely right. Emil Jannings as Mephisto, Camille Horn as Gretchen. Like, Gösta Ekman, I think, like a sort of legendary Swedish actor, is genuinely incredible, and is like the moment where you see the transitions between old and young Faust, even though you can see the kind of seams of the shots trying to join up. Like, I still think it's just an amazing bit of cinematic magic.
Oh, I totally agree. And I think this takes us in to the discourse zone nicely. So we could talk about utopianism and special effects a little bit here. So here's kind of my, this, I don't even think this qualifies as a hot take, because we were just complaining about talkies, and that's the silliest thing we've ever done on the show. But I think, you know, like to pick up what I was saying in the, I almost said Precy, but dear listeners, there was only a reading from the Licorice Guy's book today. As I was saying earlier, like, because like those comments I was just making about talkies, right? Like, talkies destroyed the art of cinema. Actors don't have to act anymore. Those are taken directly from the commentaries of critics as talkies were rolling out.
Yeah.
People, a lot of like snooty people genuinely thought that the talkie was going to kill cinema, because now it's not art anymore, that they get to talk on screen. And I find it really interesting that that discourse is kind of reproduced every time there's like a new cinematic invention for how we do special effects. And the thing that I think is most interesting about that is it's often decoupled from larger discussions of materialism and capitalism, where we talk about special effects purely from an artistic standpoint, and we don't kind of like tie that back into the material world that like fixes those special effects onto the screen. And the thing that I was thinking about while I was watching this is, like, I've seen so many silent expressionist films rescored with either live orchestras doing their own thing, or like a rock band rescoring it, or like an experimental noise band rescoring it. There's like a synthwave artist that's been rescoring a bunch of like classic silent films. And like, that's like, oh, these formats are still alive. Like, they've never been supplanted by capitalism. Capitalism didn't kill the silent movie when it invented the talkie, in massive quotes here. So as that is kind of like a kicking off point, I'm wondering what are your thoughts, since this is the utopian discussion with the at utopian guy?
Yeah, I mean, like, what is it that we want from these things? Like, why is it, why is it that Faust has been a story told for 500 years? This idea, like, what is it that Faust wants that we respond to? And Faust wants quite a lot in the course of this film. So firstly, he wants knowledge, then he wants youth, and he wants kind of pleasure, and finally he wants love, right? And we'll get onto the ending, because I think the ending is really interesting in that it is so cosmically bleak. But there's a very famous quote by Bloch, which I think is worth kind of picking up on here, which is like, Bloch says, "To think is to transgress." Or to overcome. And I think we live in an intellectual climate and a political climate in which a lot of people make a very big deal or a very big noise about their ability to transgress, that they are transgressive, and they're saying all of the things that other people... But, like, there's no actual thought here. Like, we don't encounter the new when you listen to somebody on Joe Rogan tell millions of people that, like, you know... Maybe there's some shady things happening in the finance world. There's no actual... that isn't a transgression to say that kind of thing, right? And I think what's interesting about Bloch's interest in Faust is his belief that Faust's essential kind of drive out of himself, even if it leads into disaster, is innately, inherently a deeply human response and a deeply utopian drive, right? What is it that Faust wants? Faust wants to be human for the first time. There's that amazing moment where Mephisto shows him a vision and says, what is it you want? And he says, Heimat. He wants to go home. He wants to be at peace in the world. And it's like, that's the bit where like Bloch would be sitting up and pointing with his pipe, you know, like the meme of Leo DiCaprio. But it's like, because this is Bloch's central kind of philosophical claim, which is like, what is utopia? Politically, utopia is communized existence. It's a communist society. Existentially, mm-hmm. like ontologically, what is it? It is the place where one can be at home in the world for the very first time, where you actually, like, Heimat is not just like going back to where you grew up. It's not nostalgic. Heimat is this idea of like ending your own kind of ontological alienation from existence, and or in philosophical terms, collapsing the distinction between subject and object.
Ooh, I really like that. That is incredibly, incredibly interesting. So in this film in particular, like what I find to be interesting is the kind of journey that Faust has to go on in order for we, the viewer, to kind of like experience his, like, I guess, like the utopian impulse within Faust. And that's, you know, we see something that I think is like really common, a common experience to people outside of academia as well. And that Faust realizes his phony baloney job sucks and can't actually do anything.
Yeah. Well,
and he has to.
It's so good. Oh, go on. It's so good. This notion of like, it's all useless, right? You know, it's honestly the opening. Not only is like the opening like so technically just mind blowing, it's also deeply emotionally moving, because you Faust essentially comes to recognize his own like superfluity, right? He's in the case of a plague, what good is a learned man? Like, what good is all your knowledge against the ultimate destination of human finitude, which is death?
And even I think even beyond that too, like it's not just that he's like some like useless academic during a plague and he can't contribute usefully to society at that point. You know, we get like one glimpse into what Faust is writing before he's given demon juice that makes him useful in the world. And that's like we see like one page and it's something like, the virtue of man is the friendship found all over earth. And then we see like a whole auditorium of people clap, and I'm just like, that is the most like a bunch of random people in charge of your department at the university are encouraging you to do this absolutely benign, useless junk work. And then they all applaud because you're just greasing the kind of like, in our case, like this, you know, decaying neoliberal machine. And in Faust's case, like, yeah, everyone's just celebrating, and then there's this plague going on outside, like Faust actually did anything there. And I think that also speaks to your earlier point too about transgression.
Yeah, exactly. Like what is it? What would a genuine transgression look like in the era of like contemporary modernity? What does that transgression look like? And I'm like, that's the challenge of Bloch's utopian philosophy, right? Because like this kind of pseudo-reactionary, which it's just like very boringly conservative intellectual discourse of like, oh, we're saying all the things that nobody would dare say, is such a productive part of the intellectual climate we exist in. It's in no way transgress. It's part of the ecosystem, right? And it's like in post-modernity, the great act of transgression is sincerity.
I totally agree.
It's no surprise that for particularly the reactionary political right, they're doing religion as the act of transgression, either Islam or you know, the Tradcaths. But like, is that particularly transgressive? Not really, I don't think. So, but Faust is the one who is willing to like, what would it take to be a different kind of person? Would you be willing to not only radically change your life, but to like put your very soul into danger, damn yourself? Would you be willing to damn yourself for all eternity if it meant you could break out of like the stale existence that you found yourself in? And the answer for Faust is yes.
So the thing that I think is super fantastic about the point that you just came up with there, like that reading is so strong. And I think that's because like, the thing that changes for Faust when he makes the deal, right, and trades away his mortal soul for a bunch of cool powers and useful stuff, is not him being damned or otherwise, because we find out in the course of watching this movie that it's actually decided beforehand. Like, the status of his soul is a bet between the Archangel Michael and the demon Mephisto, right? They're betting if a good man can become corrupt or not, right? It's a very, very classic setup. And Faust is just that unlucky guy. He was just picked. He's God's favorite academic, and here he is picked to get a horrible job. And I think that is kind of utopian in a way, that the realization that Faust has to come to is that, like, is not that he had to, like, suffer through damnation to kind of earn something great, a great prize at the end. It's to realize he was damned to begin with.
This is why I really like that bit from the beginning of the third volume of The Principle of Hope, where Bloch says, we have mm-hmm. in us what we could become. And it's like, mm-hmm. in the case of Faust, right, this is a young man who became an old man, like a man who really loved pleasures and being at his home and falling in love, who traded it for, like, books and death. And it's like, mm-hmm. no matter who you are, the great kind of, like, it's a deeply existential philosophy in a way, because Bloch is, the academic Johann Siebes has a really good point about this, that Bloch is essentially a philosopher with two faces, looking back to classical German philosophy, classical German idealist philosophy, on the one hand, and looking forward to Marxism and existentialism on the other. And it's like this idea of, like, kind of, Bloch is not trying to reinscribe a sort of, like, banal humanist notion of, like, mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want with yourself. He's like, actually, it's much more radical than that, because his point is, like, you don't even know who you are now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He has this amazing line called where he talks about the darkness of the lived moment, right? You cannot at the foot of the lighthouse there is no light. So he's like, mm-hmm. you have to look backwards so that you can even conceptualize what it means to look forward in the first place.
Hell yeah. Oh, this is such a fun discussion. I'm so happy we're doing this through Faust as the vehicle for this.
But yeah, I love that sentence. The desire to begin something new, which begins with ourselves. Attempts have always been made to live commensurately with ourselves. We have in us what we could become. It's like, this, I think Mark Fisher talked about this a little bit, which is like, do people really want revolution? You know, what if you held a protest and everybody mm-hmm. came?
Yep.
Live Aid, where people said abolish poverty, as if, like, who, as if there's a guy in a room who's going to be like, oh, okay, beep, we'll press the abolish poverty button.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Bloch was, and I think this is something that maybe puts people off a lot of utopian philosophy, like, it gets reduced down into this banal, like, liberal idealism, where you go,
yes.
Oh, it's utopian because, like, nice things are happening to the people I like. like, when things have a happy ending, that's utopia. It's like, Bloch was a militant communist,
mm-hmm.
and, like, believed that, like, utopia is a quantitative and qualitative different mode of life, but, like, we do not yet appreciate the full depth of our own inward resources. We don't remember yet what we're capable of doing. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's the kind of, like, beauty of Faust for Bloch, I think, is that there is, that's the utopian element in it. Like, the old man can, like, in this film anyway, the old man can remember who he was, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like that you bring Fisher into the conversation too, because we have in Fisher, I think, the same kind of, like dual aspect, because we have the Mark Fisher of the kind of inescapable lead horizon of capitalist realism, hemming in everything from our artistic output to our careers to our, you know, work as people on the left trying to make a better world. And then we have the Mark Fisher of acid communism, which I think is very utopian, and utopian not in that, like, trite liberal Live Aid wish poverty away sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people misunderstand and misread Fisher as this, like, doer pessimist, mm-hmm. and like, but this is the function and the vital importance of negativity in the philosophical tradition, right? You can't
Mm-hmm.
Like, the point of Fischer's negativity is that it clears the space for something better.
Yes.
And I think that's why Bloch is so... is very underappreciated still. And what Bloch provides is, like, a way of viewing the entire sweep of human history that goes, actually, all of these things which capitalism will tell you are past, like great culture, great music, great literature, mm-hmm. ruins even, all of those things which are in the past are not meaningful anymore. Because actually, no, all of that has this deep kind of layer of content, this deep catalytic possibility within it that is formative of our present in ways we still don't fully understand.
Absolutely. And that's reminding me of our conversation of Only Lovers Left Alive. And I think this is all like perfectly Faustian, perfectly negative in that proper philosophical tradition too. Because what needs to happen to Faust in order for him to kind of realize his potential, discover what he wants in the world, actually grow for what could be the first time in his adult life, is he needs to have his position destroyed, right? He needs to kind of like... He needs to have his perception destroyed, because he perceives himself as comfortable and successful and happy as an academic, and he gets that shattered by going back out and encountering the actual conditions of the world.
Yeah.
You know, he leaves the ivory tower, or he's forced out of the ivory tower, rather, right? He gets that very, appropriately philosophical injection of the negative that clears the decks and allows him to kind of, like, have a clarity that was obfuscated by all of this false positivity.
I mean, I think we should talk about the ending then. So, like, it's Gretchen that he falls in love with. Mm-hmm. Gretchen ends up... So Gretchen's brother kind of realizes that he's in league with the devil. Gretchen ends up pregnant with Faust's child. The child dies mm-hmm. of it gets so dark. It's so grim. Like the scenes where Gretchen's child dies in the snow because of exposure, and then she's arrested as a murderer. It's just brutal.
It's so grim.
And like Faust loses his youth right at the end. And so Mephisto famously smashes the mirror and he runs. It's this old man who throws himself into the flames. It's like unrelentingly depressing. But what do you think about the ending? Do you think they save it at the end? Do you think they kind of like...
I mean, I think in a very practical and historical sense, the ending of this movie struggles with the fact that Faust is a German folktale that's been retold, re-recorded, and respun by a lot of people over many hundreds of years, each of them with different goals and political aims. And so the end of this is attempting to do like the, a tightrope walk between like, we have something salvific, right? Because at the end of the Archangel Michael is like, haha, I actually won because by Faust doing something out of an act of love, he redeemed his soul at the end. And then you kind of have like, in a way, Mephisto actually won because Faust died in total misery as he lived. And I think it does provide us again with like this kind of like this negative philosophical direction that paves the way towards something utopian, right? Like I love the scene where Mephisto smashes the mirror, because for me, that's like, you know, we have like this dialectic movement through Faust, right? Because you think that when he first encounters Mephisto, that's his encounter with the real, right? You know, he goes and he tries to cure the plague. He sees the world. He travels. He falls in love. But then at the end, you know, you get this kind of like negative tie that brings you back in, because no, he's still old. He's still that old man. And now like in a way that him jumping in the fire is kind of the first action he takes in the whole movie.
Yes, exactly. And like I feel like the people maybe find the argument of, oh, but it's love. What's the real utopia is love. maybe that's a little bit too easy for people. And I certainly don't think it completely mollifies the like sheer like emotional pessimism and bleakness of the end, But you're, I think you're completely right that like this is the moment of like where even as the old man, right, when even when all of the powers may have been quote unquote taken away, the mirror has been smashed, he still has within himself the agency to do something like kind of extraordinarily like strange and otherworldly.
Yeah, it is. So it is the first time he's using like if we're to kind of like approach this from like, you know, you mentioned comic books earlier. So let's approach Faust from like a comic book perspective, right? You know, in kind of what would be a classic occult Marvel, probably superhero, Faust gets powers from the devil. But like it's really at the end of the first time where he is agential, right? Where the first time where he is powered or has power in the capital P sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he's willing to sacrifice so much for someone who's suffering, right? And I think that is such a powerful ending. And like I think one of the things worth coming around to a little bit is like you mentioned sincerity earlier, and like I think we're so beguiled by cringe in our age. We're beguiled by the fact that we're like viewed and spied upon eternally by these like false Archangel Michaels and these false Mephistos, you know, that are social media. That's the surveillance state. That's the kind of panopticon that's always viewing us. And we want to, we're acting perpetually, right? We want to present ourselves as being and existing in a particular way. But like, love is incredibly powerful. Love can actually span these gaps and reach across these chasms and give us strength beyond what Mephisto or Michael could provide. And here's Faust, who is a dork academic who went on a little misadventure, kind of finally realizing the true power of that. And in a way, I think that's like incredibly moving and forces us to, in a way, smash our own little Mephisto mirror here to kind of see beyond the act that we're playing.
There's I can't remember exactly where it is, but there's this great bit by Block where he's talking about like if a situation, if the world is not completely determined, you know, mm-hmm. then you can't raise an objection to utopia on purely factual grounds. And it's like mm-hmm. what I love about it is this, there is a kind of fetishizing of performance, but also like of facts, of just common sense, of like, well, everybody should do this, or like that's the kind mm-hmm. of mantra of the modern age, isn't it? Like, this is the way that everybody should live. Why? Mm-hmm. Because these are the facts. And Block is like, the facts, purely factual reality is nothing, because it ignores the kind of deep, the very fact that we don't know ourselves means that within us there are things that we have not yet realized. Right.
Yes.
If you allow yourself the dizzying freedom of examining it, of living in such a way as to take seriously this sense of there is within you what you want to be, it goes beyond this like purely factual reality. Reality is not closed, right? There are forces which condition it, but there is what Block called the concretely real possible. That within mm-hmm. that conditioned existence, there are all kinds of latencies and possibilities that have the potential to kind of radically remake it. Even Fisher, for all of his kind of pessimism, was talking about this right at the end of Capitalist Realism, where it's like, where from a situation like everything seemed closed, suddenly everything could happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take much, right? It doesn't take much
yes.
to put a tear in that gray horizon.
And I think, I think there's two things that I want to like build off of this point is that like, you're absolutely right. It doesn't take much, because I think the necessary amount that it has taken has already been conducted on a widespread social fabric, right? Faust needs to go through this gigantic misadventure and then experience like true suffering at the end as he watches a person he loves be burnt to death to kind of bridge the gap and realize the power of love. But we've all already experienced that. We're all already going through that every single day. You know, like the death is just abstracted by a single layer of metaphor through Capital, right? And then, so like, in a way, the kind of mystic blood sacrifice has been made, right? We've paid our penance already, though the waiting is no longer necessary. And then I think, oh my God, what the hell was the other thing? Because the other thing was the actual thing I was thinking of. Oh, facts. Yeah. So I think what's really interesting about the right is the right currently loves quote unquote facts, right? Like they love factual information, right? We've got the fucking Ben Shapiro's often parodied line, facts don't care about your feelings. You know, we've got all of these fucking transphobes who are like, well, actually, if you measure the blood viscosity or just some whatever fucking nonsense they're going to make up tomorrow to try and pin gender to pin a social construct to biological, you know, truths.
Let me break out my phrenology calipers.
Yeah. Yeah. Click, yeah. Where's my calipers here? And like that's all that they're doing is they're just respinning phrenology. And what do we know about phrenology? All the facts were bullshit. Because facts by definition are trite. You know, I can tell you when F.W. Murnau's Faust came out, but that tells you virtually nothing about the movie, right? Those facts require an endless chain of interpretation, right? And that interpretation is bound up into philosophy. It's bound up into theoretical approaches. It's bound up into emotion, right? Like facts may not care about your feelings, but facts are definitionally trite.
Yes.
And I think that comes out here in the end of this film.
And, you know, Gretchen is the one I sort of feel for, because in a way,
yes,
she's the one who is sort of instrumentalized, yes, by both Faust and Mephisto, right?
And by the Archangel Michael.
And by the Archangel Michael.
This poor woman was just living her random little existence, and then the heavenly powers were like, oh, we gotta gamble on Faust's morality. Who can we throw in his way?
Yeah. But it's I, you know, haven't we all taken on the gold chain? Right? Mm-hmm. Right? Haven't we all been in some ways seduced by this, actually, the kind of naturalization of the order of things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, suddenly we go, oh, well, maybe it would be like. And then it suddenly seems as if so many things are out of our control, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've accepted that naturalization. We've accepted, yes, the incipient logic of, you know, there is no alternative. But if anything, and I think this is something that blocks, like, if you've never read it, The Principle of Hope is a genuinely, like, jaw-dropping book.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 1,600 pages long. You can find in three volumes in English, and it is essentially an argument that every aspect of human existence, human sociality, and human culture contains within it, not like, oh, this is the way things are, but like, there are so many things within them that have been deliberately maligned and deliberately kind of, mm-hmm, eliminated from our sense of ourselves. And like, the wonder is not that things are the way they are, but like, so many other things have not happened yet, right? That's this truly strange,
yes,
thing. And it, yeah, I feel like Gretchen, I think, is such an instrumentalized figure. And I think it's so important that, like, the utopian impulse redeems that instrumentalization of human subjectivity. Right, it's not just.
I think you're,
it's,
yeah.
Is it? It's not just Faust who needs saving.
No, absolutely not. And I think it's also important to, like, oh my God, this is welcome to Film Studies 101. In a way, the screen of the film is like a mirror that's projecting back onto you. Yeah. Uh huh. Mm-hmm. We're real deep here on this show. We are so smart. But when Mephisto smashes that mirror, right? It is also a smashing of our connection with the film, right? Our relationship oh my God, I can't speak today. Our relationship to Faust is smashed alongside that mirror, right? You know, we should now question how and why we were so invested in this protagonist, and how and why we were so kind of eerily okay with this woman being instrumentalized by all the men in this movie. And I think that extrapolates back out onto us, because, like, you know, we're watching these kind of like, you know, like, if you will, an invisible hand instrumentalize this woman and turn her existence into a tool for Faust and the gambling of these patriarchal agencies. And we see that like back out in the world, right? Whether it's by gender, whether it's by class, race, ability, sexuality, so on and so forth. You know, we are all of us to a one getting instrumentalized by the machinery of oppression. And like, you know, there's kind of this there's like a graveyard poetry hope that I've like, you know, because I was introduced through to Block's works through you, and I've been, you know, doing it. Oh my god, there's so much Block to read. Listeners, I'm so happy that there's a Block primer out there now that can get me started. Links in the show notes, buy the book. I'm saying this in a low tone right now to try and get you to buy the book subliminally. buy the book. But no, I think what's really interesting is you know, I would contrast, because like right there at the end of this film, there's an impulse to succumb to defeat, to doomerism, if you will, right? There's an impulse to go like, oh, well, you know, we still have this deeply misogynistic tone at the end of this film. We have Faust is dead. You know, we have these people who are immortal, invincible, and, you know, capriciously gambling on human fate living on. But I think that there's still something hopeful and there's still something utopian, because no matter how far things feel like they've slipped, and this speaks to what you were just talking about the real, about facts, about potential, like no matter how far things feel like they've slipped, we do not yet know what we can do, what can be salvaged. We do not yet know the extent to which we ourselves can experience and participate in salvific directions for society. And like, I use such a lofty term intentionally here, because we're talking about love, we're talking about utopia, we're talking about saving the world.
Yeah. And seeing it remade.
Like, yes. Mm-hmm.
This is maybe the flip side of that, which is that the world has to end. This world has to end.
Yes. Why? Because, here we go.
Because without it, the new can't come into being. There has to be an mm-hmm. end. Like, I think about China Mabel's point of like, we live in utopia already. It just doesn't belong yes. to us all the mm-hmm. time. Like, this is the best of all possible worlds for a very small group of people, and for the utopian process to continue, for the outworking of the spirit of utopia to fulfill itself. That world that is the best of all possible worlds for some is going to end. It just will. Because otherwise, you know, how many more people will be sacrificed and burned as corpses to keep that mm-hmm. world living?
Absolutely. Abso-fucking-lutely. It's almost as if we're going through some kind of like collective bad trip that's been sublimated into these neoliberal discourses of positivity. It's almost like we're experiencing something like that, something you can read about, listeners, in roughly 1 year's time.
Yeah, I really hope that there's someone out there who's utilizing, let's say, like Western Marxist philosophy and psychedelic media culture to make a yeah. critique of this. But come back in a year.
Who's to say? Come back in a year when we're discussing like Holy Mountain in the context of book forthcoming 2025. Oh, this is gonna be fun, because we have so many of these like book plug episodes to do. These are gonna be really exciting.
Yeah, it's gonna be so much fun.
This is just great. So we are at roughly the 1 hour mark here. I could talk about Faust all day. We could both talk about Block all day. You could talk about Faust all day. What am I saying? We could both talk about Faust all day. We could wager on whether or not Faust will become a moral person by the end of a trail of suffering. But do you have any parting thoughts for us?
Parting thoughts. It's very simple. Read Ernst Bloch. It's beautiful. It's mm-hmm. mind expanding. It is profoundly inspirational. And buy the book. Buy A Primer on Utopian Philosophy. It is out now on Zero Books as part of the Zero Utopia series. It has an absolutely sick cover that was designed by Acid Horizon.
It's so good.
The book is beautiful. And I genuinely should say thank you to everyone who's listened to the show, because like working out these ideas on Block and like getting interested in Ernst Block probably wouldn't have happened without listening to Ash and talking with Ash and talking with everyone else who's come on the show, and like actually trying to figure out a way of finding the hope in horror, and hope that wasn't like this cheap, like if you're tired of like a politics which buys its hope on the cheap, and you're exhausted by a kind of doomerism that doesn't seem to think that there is anything in the world worth saving, read Block, because it's the revelation of the philosophy of hope as something so kind of mind-expanding. It requires you kind of like rethink your definition of philosophy from the ground up. The principle of hope is great. It's full of very short sections. If you are super interested in like religious philosophy, read Atheism and Christianity. If you want some really good stuff on the sociology of fascism, read Heritage of Our Time. If you want something on like a selection of essays and talks, there is The Utopian Function of Art and Literature, which was a collection of stuff from post-World War II. The Spirit of Utopia is beautiful and extremely kind of moving, and has an incredible 200 pages on the philosophy of music. Like, he's written about everything, and like is proof that you can be interested in everything. And The Primer is a very small offering to encourage people to prime the pump, to like to allow people to feel like they can take up the continuing work of a philosophy of hope that is rigorous, that is militant, and existentially meaningful.
Beautiful. I couldn't think of a better way to close this episode. Listeners, that's A Primer to Utopian Philosophy, out now from Repeater Books. Links will be in the show notes. Stay spooky, stay utopian.
Yeah. Boom.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week, stay spooky.